I'm very sorry. Hey, you tried, Larson said with a sad smile. At least now I won't die of thirst in a suit locker. Admiral Souther will know about this, Holden said. I'll make sure everyone knows. Seriously, Larson said, floating next to the button that would turn the Agatha King into a small star for a few seconds. He pulled off his helmet and took a long breath. There's another airlock 3 decks up. If they aren't in the elevator shaft yet, you can make it. Larson, you should go away now. Holden had to strip off his suit in the King's airlock. It was covered in the goo, and he couldn't risk taking it onto the Razorback. He absorbed a few rads while he stole another UN vac suit from one of the lockers and put it on instead. It looked exactly like the one Larson was wearing. As soon as he was back on the Razorback, he sent the remote command codes to Souther's ship. He was nearly back to the Rocinante when the King vanished in a ball of white fire. Chapter 50. Bobby.
The captain just left, Amos said to Bobby when he came back into the machine shop.
She floated half a meter above the deck inside a small circle of deadly technology. Behind her sat her cleaned and refitted recon suit, a single barrel of the newly installed gun gleaming inside the port on its right arm. To her left floated the recently reassembled auto shotgun Amos favored. The rest of the circle was formed by pistols, grenades, a combat knife, and a variety of weapon magazines. Bobby took one last mental inventory and decided she'd done all she could do.
He thinks maybe he's not coming back from this one, Amos continued, then bent down to grab the auto shotgun.
He looked it over with a critical eye, then gave her an appreciative nod.
Going into a fight where you know you aren't coming back gives you a sort of clarity, Bobby said.
She reached out and grabbed her armor, pulling herself into it. Not an easy thing to do in microgravity. She had to twist and shimmy to get her legs down into the suit before she could start sealing up the chest. She noticed Amos watching her. He had a dopey grin on his face. Seriously, now, she said, we're talking about your captain going off to his death, and all that's going through your head right now is, oh, boobies. Amos continued to grin, not chastened at all.
That bodysuit don't leave a lot to the imagination, that's all.
Bobby rolled her eyes.
Believe me, if I could wear a bulky sweater inside my fully articulated power-assisted combat suit, I still wouldn't, because that would be stupid.
She hit the controls to seal the suit, and her armor folded around her like a second skin. She closed the helmet, using the suit's external speakers to talk to Amos, knowing it would make her voice robotic and inhuman.
Better put your big boy pants on, she said, the sound echoing around the room.
Amos took an unconscious step back.
The captain isn't the only one that might not be coming back.
Bobby climbed onto the ladder lift and let it take her all the way up to the ops deck. Avasarala was belted into her couch at the comm station. Naomi was in Holden's usual spot at the tactical panel. Alex would be up in the cockpit already. Bobby opened her visor to speak using her normal voice.
We cleared?
She asked Avasarala. The old lady nodded and held up one hand in a wait gesture while she spoke to someone on her headset mic.
The Martians have already dropped a full platoon, she said, pushing the mic away from her face. But their orders are to set up a perimeter and seal the base while someone further up the food chain decides what to do.
They're not going to... Bobby started, but Avasarala cut her off with a dismissive wave of her hand.
Fuck no, she said. I'm further up the food chain, and I've already decided we're going to glass this abattoir as soon as you're off the surface. I'm letting them think we're still discussing it so you have time to get the kids.
Bobby nodded her fist at Avasarala. Recon Marines were trained to use the Belter's physical idiom when in their combat armor.
Avasarala just looked baffled at the gesture and said, "So stop playing with your hand and go get the fucking kids." Bobby headed back to the ladder lift, connecting to the ship's one MC as she went. "Amos, Prax, meet me in the airlock in 5 minutes, geared up and ready to go. Alex, put us on the deck in 10.
"Roger that,"
Alex replied.
"Good hunting, soldier."
She wondered if they might have become friends, given enough time. It was a pleasant thought. Amos was waiting for her outside the airlock when she arrived. He wore his Martian-made light armor and carried his oversized gun. Prax rushed into the compartment a few minutes later, still struggling to get into his borrowed gear. He looked like a boy wearing his father's shoes. While Amos helped him get buttoned up, Alex called down to the airlock and said,
"Heading down. Hang on to something."
Bobby turned her boot mags to full, locking herself to the deck while the ship shifted under her. Amos and Prax both sat down on chairs that pulled out from the wall and belted in. "Let's go over the plan one more time," she said, calling up the aerial photos they'd shot of the facility. She patched into the Rossi and threw the pictures onto a wall monitor. "This airlock is our entrance. If it's locked, Amos will blast it with explosives to open the outer door. We need to get inside fast. Your armor isn't going to protect you from the vicious radiation belt Io orbits in for long. Prax, you have the radio link Naomi rigged, so once we're inside, you start looking for a network node to plug it into. We have no information about the layout of the base, so the faster we can get Naomi hacking their system, the faster we can find those kits."
"I like the backup plan better," Amos said.
"Backup plan?" Prax asked.
"The backup plan is I grab the first guy we see and beat him until he tells us where the kids are."
Prax nodded.
"Okay, I like that one too."
Bobby ignored the macho posturing. Everyone dealt with pre-combat jitters in their own way. Bobby preferred obsessive list-making. But flexing and threats were good too. "Once we have a location, you guys move with all haste to the kids while I ensure a clear path of egress."
"Sounds good," Amos said.
"Make no mistake," Bobby said. "Io is one of the worst places in the solar system. Tectonically unstable and radioactive as hell. Easy to see why they hid here, but do not underestimate the peril that just being on this shit moon carries."
2 minutes,
Alex said over the comm. Bobby took a deep breath. "And that isn't the worst. These assholes launched a couple hundred human proto-molecule hybrids at Mars. We can hope that they shot their entire wad, but I have a feeling they didn't. We might very well run into one of those monsters once we get inside." She didn't say, "I've seen it in my dreams." It seemed counterproductive. "If we see one, I deal with it. Amos, you almost got your captain killed blasting away at the one you found in the cargo bay. You try that shit with me, I'll snap your arm off. Don't test me."
"Okay, chief," Amos replied. "Don't get your panties in a twist, I heard you."
1 minute,
Alex said.
"There are Martian Marines controlling the perimeter, but they've been given the okay to let us in. If someone escapes past us, no need to apprehend them. The Marines will pick them up before they get far."
30 seconds.
"Get ready," Bobby said, then pulled up her HUD suit status display. Everything was green, including the ammo indicator, which showed 2,000 incendiary rounds. The air sucked out of the airlock in a long, fading hiss, leaving only a thin wisp of atmosphere that would be the same density as Io's own faint haze of sulfur. Before the ship hit the deck, Amos jumped up out of his chair and stood on his toes to put his helmet against hers. He yelled,
"Give 'em hell, Marine!"
The outer airlock door slid open, and Bobby's suit blatted a radiation alarm at her. It also helpfully informed her that the outside atmosphere was not capable of supporting life. She shoved Amos toward the open lock and then pushed Prax after him.
"Go, go, go!"
Amos took off across the ground in a weird, hopping run, his breath panting in her ears over the radio link. Prax stayed close behind him and seemed more comfortable in the low gravity. He had no trouble keeping up. Bobby climbed out of the Rossi and then jumped in a long arc that took her about 7 meters above the surface at its apex. She visually scanned the area while her suit reached out with radar and EM sensors, trying to pinpoint targets. Neither she nor it found any. She hit the ground next to the lumbering Amos and hopped again, beating them both to the airlock door. She tapped the button and the outer door cycled open. Of course. Who locks their door on Io? No one is going to hike across a wasteland of molten silicon and sulfur to steal the family silver. Amos plowed past her into the airlock, stopping for breath only once he was inside. Bobby followed Prax in a second later, and she was about to tell Amos to cycle the airlock when her radio died. She spun around, looking out across the surface of the moon for a moment. Amos came up behind her and put his helmet against her back armor. When he yelled, it was barely audible. "What is it?" Instead of yelling back, she stepped outside the airlock and pointed to Amos, then pointed to the inner door. She mimed a person walking with her fingers. Amos nodded at her with one hand, then moved back into the airlock and shut the outer door. Whatever happened inside, it was up to Amos and Prax now. She wished them well. She spotted the movement before her suit did. Something shifting against the sulfurous yellow background. Something not quite the same color. She tracked it with her eyes and had the suit hit it with a targeting laser. She wouldn't lose track of it now. It might gobble radio waves, but the fact that she could see it meant that light bounced off it just fine. It moved again, not quickly, and staying close to the ground. If she hadn't been looking right at it, she'd have missed the motion entirely. Being sneaky, which probably meant it didn't know she'd spotted it. Her suit's laser rangefinder marked it as just over 300 meters away. According to her theory, once it realized it had been spotted, it would charge her, moving in a straight line to try and grab and rip. If it couldn't reach her quickly, it would try to throw things at her. All she needed to do was hurt it until its program failed and it self-destructed. Lots of theories. Time to test them out. She aimed her gun at it. The suit helped her correct for deflection based on the range, but she was using ultra-high velocity rounds on a moon with fractional gravity. Bullet drop at 300 meters would be trivial. Even though there was no way the creature could see it through her helmet's darkened visor, she blew it a kiss. "I'm back, sweetie. Come say hi to Mama." She tapped the trigger on her gun. 50 rounds streaked downrange, crossing the distance from her gun to the creature in less than a third of a second. All 50 slammed into it, shedding very little of their kinetic energy as they passed through. Just enough to burst the tip of each round open and ignite the self-oxidizing flammable gel they carried. 50 trails of short-lived but very intense flame burned through the monster. Some of the black filament bursting from the exit wounds actually caught fire, disappearing with a flash. The monster launched itself toward Bobby, at a dead run that should have been impossible in low gravity. Each push of its limbs should have launched it high into the air. It stuck to the silicate surface of Io as though it were wearing magnetic boots on a metal deck. Its speed was breathtaking. Its blue eyes blazed like lightning, the long, improbable hands reaching out for her, clenching and grasping at nothing as it ran. It was all just like in her dreams. And for a split second, Bobby just wanted to stay perfectly still and let the scene play out to the conclusion she'd never gotten to see. Another part of her mind expected her to wake up, soaking with sweat, as she had so many times before. Bobby watched it as it ran toward her, and noted with pleasure the burnt black injuries the incendiary bullets had cut through its body. No sprays of black filament, and then the wounds closing like water. Not this time. She'd hurt it, and she wanted to go on hurting it. She turned away and took off in a bounding run at a 90-degree angle to its path. Her suit kept the targeting laser locked on to the monster, so she could track its location even without turning around to look. As she'd suspected, it turned to follow her, but it lost ground. "Fast on the straightaways," Bobby said to it, "but you corner like shit." When the creature realized she wasn't going to just stand still and let it get close to her, it stopped. Bobby stumbled to a stop, turning to watch it. It reached down and tore up a big chunk of ancient lava bed, then reached down to grip the ground with its other hand. "Here it comes," Bobby said to herself. She threw herself to the side as the creature's arm whipped forward. The rock missed her by centimeters as she hurtled sideways. She hit the moon's surface and skidded, already returning fire. This time she fired for several seconds, sending hundreds of rounds into and through the creature. "Anything you can do, I can do better," she sang under her breath. "I can do anything better than you." The bullets tore great flaming chunks out of the monster and nearly severed its left arm. The creature spun around and collapsed. Bobby bounced back to her feet, ready to run again if the monster got back up. It didn't. Instead, it rolled over onto its back and shook. Its head began to swell, and the blue eyes flashed even brighter. Bobby could see things moving beneath the surface of its chitinous black skin. "Boom, motherfucker," she yelled at it, waiting for the bomb to go off. Instead, it bounced suddenly to its feet, tore a portion of its own abdomen off, and threw it at her. By the time Bobby realized what had just happened, the bomb was only a few meters from her. It detonated and blew her off her feet. She went skidding across Io's surface, her armor blaring warnings at her. When she finally came to a stop, her HUD was flashing a Christmas display of red and green lights. She tried to move her limbs, but they were as heavy as stone. The suit's motion control processor, the computer that interpreted her body's movements and turned them into commands for the suit's actuators, had failed. The suit was trying to reboot it while simultaneously trying to reroute and run the program in a different location. A flashing amber message on the HUD said, "Please stand by." Bobby couldn't turn her head yet, so when the monster leaned down over her, it took her completely by surprise. She stifled a scream. It wouldn't have mattered. The sulfur atmosphere on Io was far too thin for sound waves to travel in. The monster couldn't have heard her. But while the new Bobby was at peace with the idea of dying in battle, enough of the old Bobby remained that she was not going to go out screaming like a baby. It leaned down to look at her, its overlarge and curiously childlike eyes glowing bright blue. The damage her gun had done seemed extensive, but the creature appeared not to notice. It poked at her chest armor with one long finger, then convulsed and vomited a thick spray of brown goo all over her. "Oh, that's disgusting," she yelled at it. If her suit had been opened up to the outside, getting that proto-molecule shit on her would have been the least of her problems. But still, how the hell was she going to wash this crap off? It cocked its head and regarded her curiously. It poked again at her armor, one finger wriggling into gaps, trying to find a way into her skin. She'd seen one of these things rip a 9-ton combat mech apart. If it wanted into her suit, it was coming in. But it seemed reluctant to damage her for some reason. As she watched, a long, flexible tube burst out of its midsection and began probing at her armor instead of the finger. Brown goo dribbled out of this new appendage in a constant stream. Her gun's status light flickered from red to green. She spun up the barrels to test it, and it worked. Of course, her suit was still telling her to please stand by when it came to actually moving. Maybe if the monster got bored and wandered in front of her gun, she could get some shots off. The tube was probing at her armor more insistently now. It pushed its way into gaps, periodically shooting brown liquid into them. It was as repulsive as it was frightening. It was like being threatened by a serial killer that was also fumbling at her clothing with a teenager's horny insistence. "Oh, to hell with this," she said to it. She was about through with letting this thing grope her while she lay helpless on her back. The suit's right arm was heavy, and the actuators that made her strong when it was working also resisted movement when it wasn't. Pushing her arm up was like doing a one-arm bench press while wearing a lead glove. She pressed up anyway until she felt something pop. It might have been in the suit. It might have been in her arm. She couldn't tell yet, because she was too wired for pain to set in. But when it popped, her arm came up, and she pushed her fist up against the monster's head. "Bye-bye," she said. The monster turned to look curiously at her hand. She held down the trigger until the ammo counter read zero and the gun stopped spinning. The creature had ceased to exist from the shoulders up. She dropped her arm back to the ground, exhausted. "Reroute successful," her suit told her. "Rebooting," it said. When the subliminal hum came back, she started laughing and found she couldn't stop. She shoved the monster's corpse off her and sat up. "Good thing. It's a really long walk back to the ship." Chapter 51. Prax. Prax ran. Around him, the station walls formed angles at the center to make an elongated hexagon. The gravity was barely higher than Ganymede's standard, and after weeks at a full G burn, Prax had to pay attention to keep himself from rising to the ceiling with each step. Amos loped beside him, every stride low, long, and fast. The shotgun in the man's hands remained perfectly level. At a T-intersection ahead, a woman appeared. Dark hair and skin. Not the one who'd taken May. Her eyes went wide and she darted off. "They know we're coming," Prax said. He was panting a little.
"That probably wasn't their first clue, Doc," Amos said.
His voice was perfectly conversational, but there was an intensity in it. Something like anger. At the intersection, they paused, Prax leaning over and resting elbows on knees to catch his breath. It was an old, primitive reflex. In less than 0.2G, the blood return wasn't significantly increased by putting his head even with his heart. Strictly speaking, he would have been better off standing and keeping his posture from narrowing any of his blood vessels. He forced himself to stand. "Where should I plug in this radio link for Naomi?" he asked Amos. Amos shrugged and pointed at the wall.
"Maybe we can just follow the signs instead."
There was a legend on the wall with colored arrows pointing in different directions. ENV control and cafeteria and primary lab. Amos tapped primary lab with the barrel of his shotgun.
"Sounds good to me," Prax said. "You good to go?"
"I am," Prax said, though he probably wasn't. The floor seemed to shift under him, followed immediately by a long, ominous rumbling that he could feel in the soles of his feet.
"Naomi, you there?"
"I am. I have to keep track of the captain on the other line. I might pop in and out. Everything all right?"
"Might be stretching the point," Amos said. "We got something sounded like someone shooting at us. They ain't shooting at the base, are they?"
"They aren't," Naomi said from the ship, her voice pressed thin and tinny by the attenuated signal. "It looks like some of the locals are mounting a defense, but so far our Marines aren't returning fire."
"Tell them to calm that shit down," Amos said.
But he was already moving down the corridor toward the primary lab. Prax jumped after him, misjudged, and cracked his arm against the ceiling. "Soon as they ask me," Naomi said. The corridors were a maze, but it was the kind of maze Prax had been running through his whole life. The institutional logic of a research facility was the same everywhere. The floor plans were different. Budget concerns could change how richly appointed the details were. The fields being supported determined what equipment was present. But the soul of the place was the same. And it was Prax's home. Twice more they caught sight of people scattering through the halls with them. The first was a young Belter woman in a white lab coat. The second was a massively obese, dark-skinned man with a squat build of earth. He was wearing a crisp suit, the signature of the administrative class everywhere. Neither one tried to stop them, so Prax forgot about them almost as soon as he saw them. The imaging suite was behind a set of negative pressure seals. When Prax and Amos went through, the gust of air seemed to push them faster, urging them on. The rumble came again, louder this time and lasting almost 15 seconds. It could be fighting. It could be a volcano forming nearby. No way to know. Prax knew this base would have to have been built with tectonic instability in mind. He wondered what the safeguards were for a moment, then put it out of his mind. Nothing he could do about it, anyway. The lab's imaging suite was at least the equal of the one he'd shared on Ganymede, with everything from the spidery full resonance displays to the inferential gravity lens. In the corner, a squat, orange table showed a holographic image of a colony of rapidly dividing cells. Two doors led out, apart from the one they'd come through. Somewhere nearby, people were shouting at each other. Prax pointed at one of the doors. "This one," he said. "Look at the hinges. It's built to allow a gurney through." The passageway on the other side was warmer, and the air was more humid. It wasn't quite greenhouse level, but near to it. It opened into a long gallery with 5-meter ceilings. Fitted tracks on the ceiling and floor allowed for moving high-mass equipment and containment cages. Bays lined it, each, it seemed, with a research bench not so different from the ones Prax had used as an undergraduate. Smart table, wall display, inventory control box, specimen cages. The shouting voices were louder now. He was about to say as much, but Amos shook his head and pointed down the gallery toward one of the farther bays. A man's voice came from that direction, his tone high and tight and angry. "Not an evacuation if there's no place to evacuate to," he was saying. "I'm not giving up the one bargaining chip I have left." "You don't have that option," a woman said. "Put the gun down and let's talk this through. I've been handling you for 7 years and I will keep you in business for 7 more, but you do not..." "Are you delusional? You think there's a tomorrow after this?" Amos pointed forward with his shotgun, then began a slow, deliberate advance. Prax followed, trying to be silent. It had been months since he'd heard Dr. Strickland's voice, but the shouting man could be him. It was possible. "Let me make this perfectly clear," the man said. "We have nothing. Nothing. The only hope of negotiation is if we have a card to play. That means them. Why do you think they're alive?" "Carlos," the woman said as Prax came to the corner of the bay, "we can have this conversation later. There's a hostile enemy force on the base right now, and if you're still here when they come through that hatch..."
"Yeah," Amos interrupted. "What happens then?"
The bay was just like the others. Strickland, it was unmistakably Strickland, stood beside a gray metal transport crate that went from the floor to just above his hip. In the specimen cages, a half dozen children lay motionless, sleeping or drugged. Strickland also had a small gun in his hand, pointed at the woman from the video. She was in a harshly cut uniform, the sort of thing that security forces adopted to make their staff look hard and intimidating. It worked for her.
We came in the other hatch, Prax said, pointing back over his shoulder.
Da?
One syllable, spoken softly. It rang out from the transport cart, louder than all the weeks of explosions and Gauss rounds and screams of the wounded and dying. Prax couldn't breathe. He couldn't move. He wanted to tell them all to put the guns away, to be careful. There was a child. His child. Strickland's pistol barked, and some sort of high-explosive round destroyed the woman's neck and face in a spray of blood and cartilage. She tried to scream once, but with significant portions of her larynx already compromised, what she managed was more of a powerful, wet exhalation. Amos lifted the shotgun, but Strickland, Marion, whatever his name was, put his pistol on top of the crate and seemed almost to sag with relief. The woman drifted to the floor, blood and flesh fanning out and falling gently to the ground like a blanket of red lace.
Thank God you came, the doctor said. Oh, thank God you came. I was stalling her as long as I could. Dr. Mung, I can't imagine how hard this has been for you. I am so, so sorry.
Prax stepped forward. The woman took another jerking breath, her nervous system firing at random now. Strickland smiled at him, the same reassuring smile he recognized from any number of doctor's visits over the previous years. Prax found the transport's control pad and knelt to open it. The side panel clicked as the magnetic locks gave up their grip. The panel rolled up, disappearing into the cart's frame. For a terrible, breathless moment, it was the wrong girl. She had the black, lustrous hair, the egg-brown skin. She could have been May's older sister. And then the child moved. It wasn't much more than shifting her head, but it was all that his brain needed to see his baby in this older girl's body. All the months on Ganymede, all the weeks to Tycho and back, she'd been growing up without him.
She's so big, he said. She's grown so much.
May frowned, tiny ridges popping into being just above her brow. It made her look like Nicola. And then her eyes opened. They were blank and empty. Prax yanked at the release on his helmet and lifted it off. The station air smelled vaguely of sulfur and copper. May's gaze fastened on him, and she smiled. Da, she said again, and put out one hand. When he reached for her, she took his finger in her fist and pulled herself into his arms. He held her to his chest, the warmth and mass of her small body, no longer tiny, only small, was overwhelming. The void between the stars was smaller than May was at that moment. She's sedated, Strickland said, but her health is perfect. Her immune system has been performing at peak.
My baby, Prax said. My perfect girl.
May's eyes were closed, but she smiled and made a small, animal grunt of satisfaction. I can't tell you how sorry I am for all this, Strickland said. If I had any way of reaching you, of telling you what was happening, I swear to you I would have. This has been beyond a nightmare. So, you're saying they kept you prisoner here? Amos asked. Almost all the technical staff was here against their will.